Many great movies also gave us great music, music with romantic sweep, like the theme from Gone with the Wind, music that sets your nerves on edge, like the shower scene music from Psycho. My guest, John Mautcherry, wants to make sure the best film scores have a life outside of the movies. As the founding director of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, he often conducts movie music and has even restored some old scores. He has three recent albums of film music. The Sound of Hollywood features classic themes. Between Two Worlds features the film score by Eric Korngold. And Journey to the Stars features music from science fiction and horror films. Tonight he hosts an edition of the PBS Great Performances series devoted to film music. The first score that took hold of him as a child was Franz Waxman's score for The Bride of Frankenstein, which Mautcherry conducts on Journey to the Stars. John Mautcherry, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I really like the way the drum is used in this because it's either like a heartbeat, which the monster doesn't really have.
Well, yeah,
or it's like the heavy footsteps of the monster approaching. I don't know what's actually happening.
Well, what's
in the
interesting
movie when this is played. Yeah.
Well, it's the creation of the female monster.
Mm-hmm.
This whole sequence is the actual moment where they give her heartbeat, and at the beginning you see the little meter going boom, boom. Boom. And this continues through the whole sequence as a kind of, it is both the march as well as the heartbeat. And, you know, this idea also comes out of The Flying Dutchman from Wagner. But it's, of course, then later, Waxman writes the music to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and he uses boom, 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 which sounds an awful lot like the music to Jaws, which, of course, was something that John Williams knew quite well. And the use of the heartbeat, of course, is part of the animatopoetic part of Western musical language, you know. And Waxman is brilliant. It's kind of a supernatural bolero, right? I mean, the tempo doesn't move, and what we have at the end is a monster. I have Elsa Lanchester with a permanent wave.
What do you think the importance of film music is in the larger scheme of classical music and pop?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the words that is, you know, is, you hit both magic words, you hit both of my buttons at once. You said pop and you said classical. I think we have this problem with the word classical music, and I'm starting to prefer using the word classic music because I just don't understand now what classical music means. Just like pop, I think that every composer, you know, Verdi, Wagner, all of them wanted to be popular, so... all of this seems to come together in film music, which, like 19th century music, had as its basis the popular music of the time, and then they kind of elevated it or they made it more complicated by writing large symphonic scores. So the film music continued to be influenced by everything that was going on in pop music from, you know, in the 30s right through the 50s right through to today, whereas classical music, if we can use that word, stopped being influenced by popular music. In other words, you don't have tangos and you don't have rock and roll and then you don't have rap music or in any way, you know, influencing the music of Stockhausen, Boulez or whatever. They stopped that. Whereas, equivalently, in the 19th century, it was normal to have a tarantella, a march, a waltz, a song, being elevated into something which people call art music. Now, therefore, film music is in fact the thing, is the music that continued this great process. And ironically enough, you know, it comes at a time when Hitler tried to get rid of these composers, tried to get rid of every Jewish composer who ever lived. And those who escaped and lived and came to Hollywood and were successful as film composers, basically, as a result of that, their music was heard by many, many millions of more people than would have heard them if they had simply written a symphony or an opera.
Well, I think that leads us right into some other music that you've been conducting. You have a new recording of Eric Korngold's music, and he is an example of a European composer who fled the Nazis, ended up in America, and ended up writing for movies.
Right. Eric Wolfgang Korngold was one of those child prodigies. It's interesting how most of these great film composers were child prodigies. It's inevitably a story of each of them playing the violin when they were four or five, you know. And they usually had big careers as symphonic or operatic composers. They happened to be Jewish or Hungarian or whatever, and they had to flee. They came to America. They were enormously successful at writing for this new medium, and the talent for doing that, I don't think is anything different from writing, you know, operas or ballets. It's just some different requirements.
Now, a lot of the European composers who fled the Nazis ended up in the United States writing for Hollywood. Were they writing for movies in Europe, or were they writing for, you know, symphonies in the symphony hall?
It's different for each one. In other words, Franz Waxman had worked with UFA, the great film company in Berlin. He, in fact, had orchestrated the music to The Blue Angel. And then he came to Hollywood and continued writing for films. He wrote Bride of Frankenstein. Korngold had written five operas and had written a lot of symphonic works and had never written for the movies in Vienna, but in fact was invited to America in the 30s, when he could still travel back and forth, to work on Midsummer Night's Dream at the Hollywood Bowl, which became a movie. And he so loved working for the movies that he would do, you know, a movie score once every year or so, but go back to Europe and continue to write, and simply continue to write, you know, operas. He had to stay, of course, Eric Korngold, because in 1938 he was looking at a picture called Robin Hood and deciding not to write the music when his father called from Vienna and said, "You can't come home." And in fact, later on in life, Eric Wolfgang Korngold said it was Robin Hood that saved his family's life.
He couldn't go home because the Nazis had invaded Austria.
Exactly, the Anschluss, and he couldn't go back.
Now, Eric Korngold's movie scores include The Adventures of Robin Hood, Seahawk, Captain Blood, King's Row. Now, we've selected some music from Between Two Worlds, from your new recording, and I'd like you to explain what's happening in the movie while this passage of music plays.
Well, you know, at this point in the pictures, very early in the picture, there's the Blitz, and the characters are trying to escape from the ticket office where they're buying tickets for the ship that will take them to America, and the car is destroyed by a bomb, and the composer, who doesn't even get on the ship, is seen trying to commit suicide in his apartment, but by putting the gas on in the stove, and it all dissolves into suddenly they're all being on a ship, and they are sailing between heaven and hell, between life on the planet and life on the next plane. And so Korngold wrote this score, which it was very, you know, very personal kind of score, and full of mystery and romance. And the picture itself isn't all that good. It's pretty good, but it's not all that good.
Let's hear some of Eric Korngold's music for the film Between Two Worlds, as conducted by my guest John Mautcherry. The siren that we hear that opens this passage of music, how does that siren work in the film?
Well, again, it's what indicates to everybody that, you know, that there's going to be a bombing. And interestingly enough, at this period of time, many composers use the siren in their orchestral scores. This whole series of music that we're recording with London Records called Entarte de Musique, the degenerate music, it's amazing how many times one hears that siren. I'm sure that was the sound that terrified people more than anything, because it was the indication that in some time in the next 10, 15 minutes or minute that one might die or the buildings around you might be destroyed.
I'm glad you mentioned that this Korngold recording is part of a larger series called Antarctica Music, and that means degenerate music. That's the word that the Nazis used to describe the kind of music that they thought was dangerous. What fell under this category of degenerate music?
Well, the idea came, the word is an invented word from the 19th century, talking about people who were degenerate, in not in the sense of their behavior, but are actually physically and spiritually missing things and are actually lower than human. And then they used it for artwork, and they showed how the paintings of cubists or expressionists or impressionists were Antarctica. And then there was a display of Antarctica Musique, which was degenerate music. The people who fell, the composers, the list of composers who fell under this list that the Nazis put together, basically were Jewish composers, composers who were politically not in agreement with them, say a communist, homosexuals, gypsies, anybody influenced by jazz, black music they considered all jazz music to be black music. And all of that music, therefore, was then bundled under one title called degenerate music. This is, of course, became absurd, because all the operettas that were being performed in Berlin and Vienna were written by Jewish composers. And ironically, the very moment in which Hitler and his people were trying to get rid of music composed by Jews was exactly the moment when the Jewish population of Germany and Austria were in the full bloom of the one of the greatest renaissances of creativity known to mankind. This very small percentage of world population, the Jewish population, was suddenly coming forth with the greatest violinists, pianists, composers, singers, and directors and designers. And Erich Wolfgang Korngold is simply one of the composers on the list. And you know, Béla Bartók, who wasn't on the list, wrote the letter to the Nazis and said he was really insulted that he'd been left off because it was such an incredible group of people. And what's interesting about it is the people on this list, those who survived, then got to suffer after the war because, for some reason, you know, it would be naive of us to think that the people who ran the musical establishments of Germany and Austria suddenly were replaced by the good guys in September of 1945. I mean, who was running all the organizations? The same people. And so there was tremendous punishment for those who survived, which is why this series is essential, because 50 years later, most of this music has never been performed or recorded. It's astonishing and shocking, but true.
My guest is John Malcheri, the conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Malcheri. Tonight he hosts an edition of the PBS Great Performances series devoted to film music. You are the founding conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra.
Yes.
Which conducts a lot of film music. Is it exclusively film music?
No, but since they created this orchestra for me and had no particular idea of what the orchestra would be, I said, well, we're in Los Angeles. The musicians who play in the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra make their living playing film music. They are, in fact, the legacy, this great legacy, which is a mixture of American culture and European culture. So why don't we have our raison d'etre be, in fact, that we play this music, since these people make a living doing it every day of their lives? The result is that they are, you know, what Vienna Philharmonic is to Beethoven and Mahler, the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra is to the film music.
What do you hope the orchestra of the future will be? What would you like to see the orchestra of the future play?
Well, I would like to see what we're calling film music, because I would say we're talking about tonal orchestral music would probably be a better word for it. I would like to see that in concerts that there is no particular distinction or ghettoizing of film music, just like if you have an overture to an opera, no one says it's got to be opera night at the Philharmonic. But in fact, that good music is simply played without reference to category or where the music came from or how it was written, but simply listen to it and judge it, and if you find that it's good music, play it.
I'll tell you what I'd like to see.
Yeah, I forgot to ask you. And Terry,
yeah, you
what would you
me,
like
right.
to see? And Terry, what would you like to see?
Thank you. Yes, I would like to see orchestras playing more extended jazz works, Broadway music, film scores, in addition.
Well, you see, this is part of the ghettoization here. Now, that's why I once said the Pops concert is the worst idea of all time, because it implies that other concerts are not for people.
Well, can I stop you for a second here?
Sure.
When I think of Pops orchestras, I think of like, well, maybe in theory I like the music, but it's going to be schlocked up a little bit.
Well, that's the problem, you see, because you have this impression because of the Boston Pops arrangements, which they play continuously, that originated from the 50s and 60s.
Well, and extended into the 70s. Let me, with all due respect to Arthur Fiedler, when Saturday Night Fiedler came out after Saturday Night Fever, that really, you know, that was the final nail in the coffin.
Can I just say that you can't blame Arthur for this, just like you can't blame John for this. Part of this blame comes from, unfortunately, public television. What happened was that a normal Pops concert in the days of Arthur Fiedler is in three thirds. The first third, symphonic overtures and symphonic movements. I mean, Dvorak, Wagner, etc., Rachmaninoff. Second part of the Pops concert was either an entire Mozart piano concerto, you know, a concerto of some kind, and I mean a concerto. And then the third third was what you think of as a Pops stuff. It was dessert, okay? Then when Pops went on television and when RCA was marketing the Pops idea, they focused on that last third. So people think that a Pops concert is, you know, is Chet Atkins and his group performing for an hour or whatever it is, or just, you know, a pop soloist. Whereas in fact, I don't wish to pick on him particularly, but I think about what happens in Pops concerts throughout America. In fact, the Pops concert, as it was developed by Arthur Fiedler, was at least two-thirds, you know, rooted in classical music. Also, if you look at Arthur Fiedler's programs from, say, 1943, what was he playing? A suite from Oklahoma. In 1943, Oklahoma was brand new. He was playing contemporary music. And one of the things that's terrible about Pops concerts is so much of it is referential to a time when most of the people in the audience weren't even alive. I find that really odd. So I would like to see that there would just be concerts, and they would be a good blend of things that would take an audience on a journey. And yes, you're right. Of course, there should be jazz music, and there should be Broadway music and film music, just as there's opera music and symphony music and ballet music. It's a question of choice and to not... You know, I used to say that the 20th century suffered from hardening of the categories, and that's, in fact, what we've tried to get rid of.
I want to play something else from your... album of film music, Journey to the Stars, and it features science fiction and fantasy film music. You restored some of the score from Things to Come.
Yes.
Just say a couple of words for us before we hear an excerpt of this about why you spent so much time on this score.
Things to Come is one of the great science fiction pictures, one of the great pictures of all time, and it came from England, Alexander Korda. It predicts the Second World War and predicts the city of the future. Its influence on every science fiction picture ever made is palpable to anybody who knows it. Interestingly enough, the composer, Arthur Bliss, who became the official composer of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, was hired to write the music, and he wrote the themes with H.G. Wells present. This is H.G. Wells wrote the screenplay. So here's a case where the composer actually worked with the book writer, playing the themes before the movie was actually even filmed, and then rewriting it after the film was made. And I thought, wow, this is such a great score, and it's unavailable. And Lady Bliss, by the way, the widow of the composer, helped support the restoration of it. So it's one of the happiest things on this record, is that I had a chance to conduct and restore so much of Things to Come by Arthur Bliss.
John Malcheri, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a great pleasure.
John Malcheri is the founding conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Tonight he hosts an edition of the PBS Great Performances series devoted to film music. His latest CDs include Korngold, Between Two Worlds, The Sound of Hollywood, and Journey to the Stars, featuring music from science fiction and horror films.